All right, we'll begin with the EEOC versus Great Stakes Incorporated, and Mr. Hamlet, we'll hear from you.
May it please the court, my name is Fred Hamlet. I'm an attorney for Appellant Great Stakes, Inc. in this appeal. This appeal arises out of a civil action under Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act brought by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, originally against not only Great Stakes, Inc., but Clipper Seafood, Inc. in the United States Middle District, United States Court for the Middle District of North Carolina. The case was filed in August of 2005, and jury trial was held in October 2009. Now, I think it's important for me to mention who the parties were here. The plaintiff was the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the agency of the government charged with responsibility for enforcing Title VII, has it's an agency that has vast resources. It's not a private plaintiff. It's a government plaintiff. The defendant, Great Stakes, Inc., was a startup restaurant of less than 50 employees in Greensboro, North Carolina, at the time the action was instituted. Now, we're here today because subsequent to the jury verdict in favor of Great Stakes, Inc., a petition for fees was filed, and after an order denying that motion for award of a fees, appellant has appealed. Now, we understand that to effectuate the policies underlying Title VII, Congress intended that the adversary judicial process, which presupposes a vigorous prosecution and a vigorous defense, would work. Now, in this case, we say that the action brought by the commission was frivolous, unreasonable, without foundation.
From the beginning or after?
From the beginning. From the beginning, Your Honor, and let me explain why. The charge was filed in February 2005 by a Dorothy Carter. Now, Dorothy Carter had only worked 3 weeks for Great Stakes, Inc. when she filed that charge. Now,
I'm sorry, I'm sorry I'm going to disrupt you, but only to ask you to factor into your response to Judge Niemeyer's question, what do we make of the denial of the Rule 50 motion? And please, go
thank
ahead.
You, Your Honor.
Thank you.
First of all, we say that it was frivolous from the beginning. Why do we say that? We say that because the commission, with its vast resources, its staff, investigators, attorneys, had an opportunity to fully investigate. They sent more than 60 questionnaires out. They only got seven or eight individuals at that point that responded to them in a way that supported any claim against Great Stakes, Inc. There was a conciliation held. This is prior to litigation. The charging party was not present. That should have told them that they should have known then the charging party was not committed to this action.
How do we take the fact raised by Judge Duncan that during trial, a court had to conclude as a matter of law that it was not frivolous, but that there was enough evidence to establish a prima facie case?
Your Honor, we say that that is simply one factor. One factor to be considered, taking the light most favorable to the plaintiff, the Rule 50 motions were...
Do we have to overrule the district court as a matter of law? When the district court said, I'm not going to grant the judgment for acquittal, the case is not frivolous, it can go to the jury, For us to conclude it's frivolous, we in essence have to say the court was wrong there, don't we?
No, sir, I don't think so, because I think you have to look at the evidence as a whole. That's what we think Inter-Costco has said. That's what Judge Widener said, actually, at the end of his opinion in the Glimp case. It's one factor that the directed verdict motions were denied, but we have to look at the evidence and look at the evidence as a whole. They had one witness at trial, a witness whose testimony
was enough, according to the judge.
The judge gave them the benefit of the doubt, Your Honor.
As a practical matter, I know that dynamic. It's
yes, sir.
The judge finds it safer to let it go to the jury.
Yes, sir.
Let the jury do the job instead of the judge.
Yes, sir. Realistically, that's what was happening.
We still have that legal finding that it was sufficient, and
we could
overrule that, but in essence, we would have to be saying that the judge was just accommodating the process and making it safer, letting the jury do the task rather than the judge. But that's a pretty stringent standard.
Your Honor, we say that you have to look at the evidence that existed at trial, and yes.
Jones was the witness?
Yes, sir. They were the only witness. Dorothy Carter, not there. No other witnesses.
I don't understand why you think that matters. I mean, one witness is enough from which the jury could have inferred the existence of that the allegations occurred. I mean, the investigation did cover a number of waitresses and hostesses who alleged that they had been subjected to sexual harassment, that they may not have chosen to come forward and be witnesses doesn't mean that was not a reasonable grounds for proceeding, as I understand the law.
Well, if the magistrate said, and he gave them fair warning, he said, Miss Jones has a foggy memory. This is particularly troublesome. And so when you look at the nature of her contradictory and inconsistent testimony, she said one thing about whether Mr. Pantazis made a proposition at page 183 of her transcript, and another thing 50 pages later. The problem was that they had a witness whose memory was foggy. The magistrate found her testimony particularly troublesome because she was not able to put any of these allegations into context, and that's all they had. And they should have known. There were 6 or 7 points during the course of that litigation when they should have known. It clearly was frivolous.
But you initially argued that it was frivolous from the beginning.
Yes, ma'am, and I still argue that. It was frivolous from the beginning, and the lack of a proper investigation, no sworn statements, a lack of – why did all of these 7 to 11, whatever the number, fall away? Because there were no sworn statements, and there was no predicate due diligence done for the filing of that lawsuit. Now, when the case came alive with the filing of the lawsuit, there were 6 or 7 times when, again, they should have known. They should have known when Dorothy Carter failed 3 times to show up for her deposition. They should have known in August 2006, a year later. They should have known when Stephanie Jones testified inconsistently, repeatedly at her deposition. They should have known when Aaliyah Lovett, the other witness they had, just got up and walked out of her deposition and never came back to the case. They should have known when Jamie Jarrett said, "I supervised that hostess stand 80% of the time. I never saw anything, never heard anything. They never complained to me." And Heather Smith, who stood up there with them, one of the three, I've talked to her, she never said anything. In December of 2007, when the affidavit of Heather Smith was filed, and that's the Joint Appendix 107, they should have known. It was clearly frivolous then. But 4 or 5 months later, Magistrate Lyson, in his recommendation, said, "This is particularly troublesome. They're straddling the line. Miss Jones has a foggy memory." They were on thin ice. They were given a clear warning. Now,
well, you know, I see your red lights on. Do you
yes, sir.
Want to go into your client colleagues? time, or you want to yield and come back?
I will yield unless the court feels I have not answered the pending question.
I think we understand your position, but you do have a short rebuttal coming.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
All right, Mr. Nash.
Before you get started, I want to narrow the issues, if I could.
Yes, Your Honor.
One is a request for payment of fees under the Equal Access to Justice Act. Do you agree that that doesn't apply in this case?
No, Your Honor. Actually, we argue that the Equal Access to Justice Act would apply in this case.
I will visit the Savings Clause later. How about attorney's fees under 28 U.S.C. 1927?
And yes, Your Honor, we also argued that attorney's fees should be awarded because of 28 U.S.C. Section 1927. So, yes, we do argue that as well.
You disagree that 1927 is an attorney multiplier?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. We agree that that is.
All right.
Your Honor, if I could back up. First of all, my name is Daniel Nash, along with my co-counsel, Fred Hamlet, represent the appellant, Great Stakes, Inc. With respect to the Equal Access to Justice Act, we do argue that it would be applicable in cases like this, in Title VII. Now, the Commission argued, of course, that the plain language of the Equal Access to Justice Act makes it inapplicable to Title VII cases, but that is simply not the case. The Equal Access to Justice Act, which says, except as specifically provided by statute. So, in other words, unless fees are available under another statute, then the Equal Access to Justice Act would apply. In Title VII, the text of Title VII allows a prevailing party fees at the discretion of the court. And, of course, the Supreme Court Christiansburg defined what discretion of the court meant and of course, what the court was to consider, and for a prevailing defendant to be awarded fees, the action would have to be proven to be frivolous, unreasonable, or without foundation. And so that is the standard. That is when a prevailing defendant is allowed fees under Title VII. Now, the Equal Access to Justice Act provides fees in other situations. It provides fees when the position of the government is not substantially justified. Now, there are cases.
Your argument that standard under the EAJA is more liberal for the awarding of fees to you than under Title VII?
Yes, Your Honor.
So your argument is that the savings clause or the otherwise provided clause would apply only if it were it would eliminate duplication and you go under the other statute. But if the other statute doesn't afford it because of its stricter standard, then you could go under the EAJA. I guess that's your argument.
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact,
and you have case support for that?
Yes, Your Honor. Actually, there is a case that's very illustrative of this position. Givette versus the Office of Personnel Management. It's a Federal Circuit opinion. It's certainly not binding on this court, but it is illustrative of this point.
But we would be creating a circuit split among the circuits that hear Title VII cases, would we not?
I'm not so sure that it would be creating a circuit split.
Has any circuit that has jurisdiction over titles that hears Title VII cases in the private sector ruled in the way that you are asking us to rule?
Your Honor, the other circuits, the Fifth Circuit, the Seventh Circuit.
It was kind of a yes or no question.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then you can go on from there.
Yes, Your Honor. Other circuits have decided that fees would not be available under the Equal Access to Justice Act if there's a fee provision under another statute. So if there's another fee provision. Now, we argue that the text of the Equal Access to Justice Act does not necessarily say that. It's if fees can be provided under another statute. And so when you have a more liberal standard under the Equal Access to Justice Act, but a very stringent standard under Title VII, you're left with a situation where there is a gap in coverage, a gap where a prevailing defendant would not be entitled to fees under Title VII. but they would be entitled to fees under the Equal Access to Justice Act, which would mean that you are not superseding Title VII. You are not altering Title VII. All you are doing in those cases is that you are providing fees under the Equal Access to Justice Act where the fees would not be available under Title VII.
Wasn't the congressional purpose for the Title VII standard to prevent chilling of complaints?
Yes, Your Honor, that was one of the stated purposes of Title VII. But there is, and as my co-counsel indicated, there's a difference between the plaintiffs. There's a difference between a Title VII plaintiff that is an individual and a Title VII plaintiff that is the commission. The Supreme Court in Christiansburg, Justice Stewart, did remark that there are differences and that the differences between the commission and a private party should be considered by the district court.
One of the problems, though, that I mean, the Equal Access to Justice Act doesn't just include an exception provision. It also includes a savings provision, which says that it doesn't alter, modify, or supersede any other provision of federal law. So doesn't, under your argument, wouldn't the EAJA be superseding the attorney's fees provisions of Title VII?
No, Your Honor, because the Equal Access to Justice Act would not be changing the standard under which...
It would be superseding it in that it would be layering another remedy on top of it, would it not?
Well, it's not necessarily superseding, and it'd be... I think the Federal District Court in Gavette said it correctly when it would supplement an existing fee provision.
Well, wouldn't that frustrate, following up on Judge Floyd's question, the fee awards under Title VII were designed to give effect to the purposes of the Act, and if we now take a different standard from a different section, we might be frustrating that purpose.
No, Your Honor, I do not think that you would be frustrating that purpose because the commission is charged by statute to bring actions under Title VII. There is just simply by awarding fees against the commission does not alter
its... I'm talking about the standard. The Title VII adopts a standard which you have acknowledged is different from the standard under the EAJA. And the standard under the EAJA is more liberal in favor of you as a defendant than the standard under Title VII for you as a defendant. That's what you've argued, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, then it seems to me if we were to trump Title VII or add on a layer to Title VII with a consideration of EAJA, then that would apply in any case, and we would then be operating in some tension with the considered design of Title VII that Congress adopted.
Well, Your Honor, actually, with respect to the... What you're describing is you don't want to frustrate the purpose of Title VII. There are certainly equities to be considered, and with going back to purpose...
I think you have a lot of equities in this case, and I also, and I'll direct this to your colleagues on the other side, but I know when we look at the performance of an assistant U.S. attorney, we impose a standard on the U.S. attorney that's higher than the private litigant, the attorney represents the whole government and represents all the people and has to make a judgment about whether we prosecute and whether justice is done. And I would think the EEOC has a similar requirement, that is to not bring actions that are most marginal and based on evidence of the type that Jones gave in this case. That's a judgment that ought to be exercised, it seems to me. But that all said, the district court looked at all of this, had the parties before it, heard the government, heard your case, turned down a motion for acquittal, let it go to the jury. Jury entered a verdict for you, and then exercised discretion in view of all those proceedings which it witnessed and said, well, I don't think the standard is met. That's a pretty heavy burden for us to say the judge abused the discretion given to him.
Well, with respect, and of course, the abuse of discretion under Title VII, and there's also abuse of discretion standard with respect to whether the judge correctly decided on the EAJA argument. Judge Beatty
Wouldn't be discretion. That would be de novo, wouldn't it?
Oh, well, that the EAJA applies, I believe. And Judge Beatty did decide the EAJA argument on its merits. Now, if it may please the court if I could finish answering this one question.
Well,
while time's expired. The commission, in its response to our motion for fees, actually argued that it was the burden was on the defendant, our party, the Great States Incorporated, to show that their position was not substantially justified, which is the incorrect burden. The burden is technically on the government to show that their position is substantially justified. Now, Judge Beatty, in his decision, simply looked at our arguments to and ruling that that we did not show that the position of the government was not substantially justified. In essence, Judge Beatty placed the burden on the incorrect party, which would be error and would be reversible error.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Nash. Ms. Theron? I addressed a comment at you when you weren't even at the podium, so you're free to respond any way you wish.
I heard that. Thank you.
You can go on with your argument anyway. I just wanted to...
I will get there, Your Honor.
That's all right.
I promise. May it please the Court, my name is Elizabeth Theron, and I represent the EEOC. At council table with me is Zoe Mahood from the EEOC's Raleigh Field Office. Your Honors, as you've already observed, the district court's finding that the defendant is not entitled to recover its attorney's fees in this case is reviewable only for abuse of discretion, and any factual findings associated with that ruling are reviewable only for clear error. As you've also observed, the only part of this appeal that's reviewable de novo is whether the EJA applies to Title VII as a matter of law, which I will address later, if you wish.
I suppose if the judge applied the wrong burden of proof, that would be a legal question we'd have to decide and whether it made any difference.
Assuming you find that the EJA applies to Title VII as a matter of law, yes, Your Honor. Beginning with the Christiansburg issue, I'd like to point out the appellant has mentioned several times a distinction between the EEOC as a plaintiff and private plaintiffs, and I'd like to point out that the Supreme Court in Christiansburg expressly rejected that in footnote 20 as a basis for a distinction between granting fees to a prevailing defendant. So the Supreme Court's already spoken to that point. In Title VII cases, the standard for awarding attorney's fees to a prevailing defendant is that established by 42 U.S.C. Section 2000E5K and by the Supreme Court in Christiansburg. The statute provides that in any action or proceeding under this subchapter, the court, in its discretion, may allow the prevailing party other than the Commission or the United States a reasonable attorney's fee, including expert fees, as part of its costs. And the Commission and the United States shall be liable for costs the same as a private person. In Christiansburg, the Supreme Court explained that the purpose of Title VII's fee-shifting scheme was to allow defendants to recover fees only so that they would be protected from burdensome litigation having no legal or factual basis. And this is page 420 of Christiansburg.
So your argument is, I take it, that if we were to recognize the availability of the EJA as supplementing or gap-filling in those circumstances where Title VII does not permit recovery, we would be frustrating that purpose. Is that where you're going?
Absolutely. I mean, I'll skip to EJA if you're interested in my addressing that point. I mean, there are several. In fact, this court actually in Clay Printing, which is page 817 of Clay Printing, this court actually sort of addressed this issue in dicta. You were addressing the ADEA in Clay Printing, but what this court said was that the Supreme Court's holding in Christiansburg interpreting Title VII's fee-shifting scheme is what governs in Title VII cases as opposed to the ADEA case that was in front of it there. So this court has actually already recognized the distinction, but it wasn't the holding of that case because that was an Age Act case. So yes, essentially the legislative history of both the EJA and Title VII both make it clear that Title VII is a vigorous enforcement private attorney general statute, and the fee-shifting statute in Title VII, as the Supreme Court recognized in Christiansburg, serves an important purpose that the EJA was not meant to supersede or frustrate. So that is our position here. The question before this court, then, is whether it was an abuse of discretion for the district court to rule that this case was not frivolous, unreasonable, or without foundation under Christiansburg. The defendant has presented no argument that would compel this court to find that the district court so abused its discretion. On the issue of the dropouts in this case, I think it's really important to understand how this worked. As of June 2005, at the investigation and conciliation stage, the EEOC initially identified and interviewed 8 victims of harassment. These were real people that the EEOC interviewed, spoke to, and issued a determination of reasonable cause, finding that they had been harassed by John Pantazis, the owner of the 2 Austin's restaurant locations. So when this suit was conciliated and then filed in August of 2005, it was filed on behalf of that class of 8 victims, including Dorothy Carter at the time. What then happens is that after conciliation, these individuals start to drop out, and this is entirely from their...
I appreciate all that, and I think that the fact that you have multiple complainants enhances your enforcement decision or justifies it, maybe. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know exactly what they said, but the fact that you have multiple people complaining is indicative of something that's worth pursuing, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
You're facing a trial now, and for whatever reason, the complainants aren't around except for Ms. Jones.
Right.
Does the government at that point have a responsibility to reassess the case and decide whether to go to trial?
It does, and it did, Your Honor. The government has an obligation.
In other words, you're suggesting then you did review the deposition of Jones and decided based on what you read there that that should proceed to a trial?
Yes, Your Honor.
I read the deposition of Jones.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not a glorious display. I don't know how many people would bring a cause of action based on that. It's a it's one of those depositions that almost gets you to be totally frustrated at whether this woman is making this stuff up or not, or whether she's influenced by her colleagues around her, or what prompted her to say some of the things she said.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite thin. There were statements of some touchings, unprivileged touchings. There were to get a severe and pervasive atmosphere from that testimony,
mm-hmm.
I must say, pretty mm-hmm.
I understand that view, Your Honor. And I mean,
I asked that question earlier or pointed out in response to, in discussions with your colleagues that it seems to me, and I don't know if there's any case law to support this, but as an enforcement of the laws on behalf of the United States, that the counsel for the EEOC has some duty of circumspection to see that they reject claims which are not appropriately brought and bring the claims that are appropriately brought and make that judgment in the interest of both sides as opposed to
right.
just the pure adversary system in the private sector.
Right. Well, again, Your Honor, there's a number of things that I could say to that. I mean, first of all, as I said before, you know, as a matter of law, the Supreme Court in Christiansburg did say in footnote 20 that there is not a different standard as
That's
to...
That's not really responsive to the concern that's being articulated
no.
in all fairness. And I think, I don't think anyone is trying to put you on the spot, but even... It is fair to say that the evidence here is less than overwhelming, and I think part of what the question is going to is the concern that one feels when one is looking at this record in hindsight and trying to understand the forces that
sure.
that caused the EEOC to go forward at
right.
that juncture. And rather than talking to at least to me about
sure.
Christiansburg, it would
sure.
be more helpful if I had a better sense of what collective body of information
sure.
you believe compelled the decision to go forward.
I will, Your Honor. Thank you. I think if you look at the magistrate's discussion, which is at Joint Appendix 292, where the magistrate actually discusses her testimony and the positives and the negatives of it and what weighs into his decision to deny summary judgment, I think that's actually a really good compendium of the different pros and cons of what ultimately went into the decision to go forward with it and to consider her testimony credible. You have to understand that at the time that she's undergoing this, she is 18 and Pantazis is 65 years old.
Oh, no,
it's her first...
We take her wherever she is. I read it with the idea that this was a very young woman. She had not worked there that long. She was probably somewhat naive. I don't know if she was totally offended or not. I couldn't quite figure out For instance, they come up to the stand where they make mm-hmm. reservations, and Pantazis puts his arm around her waist, and they're looking together at the book, and she says it's around her waist, and then with prompting, he says, well, it's really the top of my buttocks. She said, yeah, it was the top of my buttocks, but it's a peculiar type of testimony. She makes a statement about something that wasn't very significant. She didn't take it as significant. And then she's prompted into saying, well, what about this? What about this? And then she almost gets inconsistent. And maybe there's enough there because we had two judicial officers reviewing it. I would have thought, though, that as a prosecutor in a case like this, the government would say we have better things to do, and it's time to let this one go. Of course, a lot of the expenses for the defendant in defending the case are incurred. I recognize also the discretionary standard. We weren't there. We weren't on the scene. I raise this with you because I think it's somewhat close. It's not a slam dunk.
I understand, Your Honor. I mean, and as the magistrate also pointed out in his decision, it was 2 years between the events in the case and when her deposition was taken. So, you know, that he acknowledged.
If you don't have it, I mean, if you don't, you look at the deposition, and it's not her testimony is not going to get any better. And if you look at that testimony and recognize, well, it's been 2 years, she's young, did she fully understand, is she going to hold up on as a witness? These are all factors you're taking into account whether to prosecute the case. And that's all you really had at the beginning of the trial, right, Jones?
Right.
Yeah, okay.
In any case, the district court, which was the one that managed this litigation from day one along with the magistrate judge, concluded in the exercise of its discretion that this claim was not frivolous and denied both of the defendant's motions for judgment as a matter of law at trial, including the second motion, which was made at the close of all evidence. This court's decision in Glimpf, where the court actually reversed a district court's grant of attorney's fees to a prevailing defendant, is really particularly instructive on this point. In Glimpf, the court noted that at the close of the plaintiff's evidence, the jury really would have had to find in her favor. And at the end, it essentially came down to competing narratives, where the plaintiff told one story, the defendant told another, and essentially it came down to a question of whose narrative to believe, and the jury found the defendant's narrative to be the more credible. And what this court said in Glimpf was that when it's simply a matter of the jury finding the defendant's narrative to be the more credible one, that's not a basis for an award of attorney's fees under Christiansburg on the basis that the case is frivolous. So we would submit that this case is very similar to Glimpf in that regard. With respect to the defendant has argued that this case was not conciliated in good faith. And as we explained in our brief, you know, this court has held repeatedly in GeoRaider, in General Electric, in Raymond Metal Products, to name only a few of the cases that have addressed this, that this court will not review the adequacy of the commission's investigations or cause findings because these do not fix legal obligations but are simply procedural prerequisites to suit. The only claim that Great Stakes really could be making in this court with respect to the pre-litigation process would be that the commission didn't attempt to conciliate in good faith. But as we explained in our brief, this claim is simply false. The initial conciliation conference in this case was held in June of 2005. The EEOC met with Mr. Hamlet, made an initial monetary demand, and he requested a week to consider it. At the end of the week, he made no counteroffer, and he specifically informed the EEOC that he refused to offer any monetary relief whatsoever. So at this point, the EEOC determined that conciliation had failed. He gave no indication that he wished to negotiate further, engage in further discussions, or reopen conciliation at any time. So as this court held in Radiator Specialty, the law only requires a good faith attempt at conciliation, and there's simply no argument that that didn't happen here. Briefly, I can address their argument that they're entitled to fees under Section 1927 for bad faith or vexatious litigation. This court held in Brubaker that Section 1927 imposes a continuing obligation in the conduct of litigation and requires a finding of counsel's bad faith as a precondition to the imposition of fees. As a
1927 is really sort of a sanctioning type provision, isn't it?
That's exactly right.
It doesn't serve the same role as the EAJA and Title VII.
That's exactly right. And in fact, even if you were to find that that were appropriate, the only fees that could be recovered would be for the discrepancy between what was caused by bad faith and what was not. It's not just for fees in general. And as the district court held, there's no basis in this case for a finding of bad faith on the part of the EEOC at any point during this litigation. As we explained in our brief, pretty much every example of what the defendant lists of what's supposedly the EEOC's vexatious or bad faith conduct was, in fact, taken directly in response to either the district court's order or to defense counsel's own actions. And if the court has any questions about any of those allegations, I'd be happy to go through them here. Otherwise.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Theron. You don't have any questions?
No further questions.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Theron.
Thank you.
All right, we have a minute from each of you, I guess. We'll start with Mr. Hamlet.
Your Honor, I'll be brief.
First of all, to the question about duty to reassess, the initial meeting in March 2005 with my clients did not go well. I think that's safe to say, between the EEOC investigator and Mr. Pantazis. And we don't believe there was any reassessment after that. Now, I notice in the brief, and
counsel just told the court that they do assess and did assess before they went to trial and made an assessment. And whether you agree with the assessment, that was a judgment they made, and the magistrate judge shared in the view that there was enough, and so did the district judge.
May I respond quickly? The affidavit of Heather Smith was filed in December of 2007. They had almost 2 years to take her deposition. They could have moved to reopen discovery to take that deposition and reassess their position.
They went to trial with the one witness, Jones. That's, yes, to me, your best argument is at that point, to decide, do we go and try this case? That would have saved a lot of fees.
They made
a judgment that they looked at Jones' testimony and said, we're going to go try the case. That was their judgment. And it seems to me you can attack that judgment if you wish, but that you're also, the EEOC has a couple of colleagues on that judgment with the magistrate judge and the district judge, and who assessed the very same record and said that's enough to go to a jury on.
Well, Your Honor, we discussed that. They had the burden of proof, and we say you have to look at all the evidence there. Now,
I read the evidence, sir, confronting them, and you heard some of my questions to counsel, but we have to keep this all in the right context, too.
Yes, sir.
And under the right standards.
And we would ask the court, should a U.S. attorney take a case to trial with that kind of evidence? Now, I think that goes
to the same standard.
All right.
The Supreme Court has made us an expression of what the U.S. attorney's duty is. I don't know if that applies to the EEOC.
Yes.
EEOC is an agency. It has other kinds of duties and responses, and I raised that only as a question, and I think it was answered. And I don't want to introduce foreign and new issues,
yes,
here.
My time's up. The bell has rung. The motion to strike due to font size, the limines in motion with all the briefs and all the attachments, my printer froze up and wouldn't work. There was so much paper coming in several days before trial. We say under 1927 we should be entitled to some fees. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Nash. I'm going to hold you to your 1 minute, all right, because you got two of you already, and you've let him go over.
Your Honors, I'll be as brief as possible. Your Honors, I just want to briefly comment regarding the equal access to justice argument. Firstly, the equities considered in the equal access to justice argument, there are several, and one of those is that you do not want the government to be permitted to use its vast resources in baseless litigation against the citizens, and you also want to curb unreasonable exercise of governmental authority. I'd like to comment, this case, as my co-counsel indicated, began in 2005, resolved in 2009. 4 years is a long time, and it's a burden on a large corporation. For a small employer, it's disastrous. Our client, Great Stakes Incorporated, went out of business during the pendency of this trial.
The problem and also, with that argument is that you're arguing against a balance that Congress struck. Congress made a policy decision with respect to how fees should be viewed under Title VII. And it's really not within our purview to revisit that. We have to find – there are certain findings that have to be made to justify an award of attorney's fees under Title VII. And we have to find that the action was frivolous, unreasonable, without foundation. I mean, there are standards that govern our determination that we're constrained by.
Yes, Your Honor. And I'm out of time, but may I briefly respond.
You can answer the question.
Okay, thank you. No, Your Honor, you're right. There are considerations. Congress has made its findings, and it has standards under Title VII. It also has – there are standards under the Equal Access to Justice Act. And just to remind this Court, as you well know, that the decision of whether or not the Equal Access to Justice Act even applies in this case is a de novo standard. And I think the different equities that are to be considered is something that can be considered de novo. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll come down and greet counsel and then proceed to the next case.